The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and the co-author of the book, Tony 10. And today, we thought we'd have a little bit of a chat about the concept of maturity. It's something that a counselling client brought up a few weeks ago with me, and this particular client has gone to a lot of GA, Gamblers Anonymous meetings over the years, and he brought up this part of the GA philosophy that I hadn't come across before. And I thought it was really interesting. We'll go through the nuts and bolts of that maybe later in this episode. But I suppose the concept of maturity is something that you'd see across all addictions. And I suppose just about, you'd see it across maturing and developing and growing as a person, you know, trying to become an adult. You know, there's that new phrase, adulting. Yeah, trying to come to terms with being an adult. And I was probably well into my 30s before I wrapped my head around that and already had kids and was kind of freaking out dealing with all this maturity stuff. And certainly all through my 20s, I was very, 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 very immature in many, many different ways. So, I mean, maturity, I think, is something definitely you see across all addictions, because if you, like me, start taking drugs and alcohol, say at a young age, it's going to impact you and delay the maturing process of your physical brain. Right? Never mind your mind and your psychology as a human being. It's going to delay the development of your physical brain, delay the development of your prefrontal cortex, which in men really only develops in the kind of mid to late 20s anyway. And then psychologically, you're engaged in this process of just acting the idiot and dodging bullets and, you know, racking up the consequences and, you know, all the normal stuff that you'd see in addictions, but even just outside of the world of addiction, just, I suppose, that process of learning to deal with the consequences of life now rather than kicking them down the road, which is, I suppose, the immature thing to do. What are your thoughts on maturity, Tony? Actually, one more thing before you jump in. One of the things we're going to do today is look at it through the prism of transactional analysis, which is a psychological approach developed by a guy called Dr. Eric Byrne, who wrote a great, great self-help book. I think it's one of the biggest selling self-help books of all time, called Games People Play. And, you know, the reason it is so popular is that it's quite an easy read. So it's quite an easy concept to wrap your head around, and it's really, really useful for anyone, you know, whether you're a family member listening to this, or if you're a person who's trying to stop gambling, or if you're well into your recovery, or for whatever reason you're listening to this, that idea of transactional analysis can be really, really helpful. Blind Boy talks about it a lot on his podcast, and, you know, it's a really useful tool to apply to your life. But we'll come back to that. Tony, thoughts on maturity before we jump in today?
Yeah, I suppose when you were giving the introduction, it definitely something that resonates with me, and I got plenty of stories to share around my recovery around maturity. And I suppose the first one, we had talked about it off air, and it does have an impact in your recovery, because, you know, we do all the self-development work. We do all the working on ourselves. We, you know, you grow into recovery as you're going on, but at times you slip back into the old headspace. You slip back into the maybe childlike behavior at times. The I want, I want, I want. An example, I've shared this, I think, with probably yourself and maybe on the podcast, but definitely with a couple of people have shared it. That was one, I think it was last summer, the summer before, I was sitting in the back garden. I was after having barbecue, sitting down, totally relaxed. I had one bottle of beer, and it just suddenly came into my head that I wanted to go down and buy something in the shop. And it wasn't going down to buy a bar of chocolate or a pack of crisps, whatever. I wanted to go down and buy the Lego Camperman. And it was like as part of it was nearly like reliving back childhood experiences. It had come into my head a few weeks ago when I saw it in the shop, and it was kind of like, it was like the seed was sown. And in that moment, I just overwhelmed me, kind of, I want this, I need this, I want this right now. And this was 5 o'clock on a whatever Saturday evening. And I found that I started to manipulate the conversation towards it. So I was, the thought popped in, and then I started manipulating the conversation around it. And same way I used to do as a child, where I'd leave magazines lying around of the new Peugeot bikes or the Argus magazine open with the Casio watches that I wanted to buy. It was very similar to that. I never forget, we were just sitting outside the back door, and I just said to my partner, I said, I really want to get that camper van. Remember I was telling you about it a couple weeks ago? And she said, no, I don't remember you saying it. I said, yeah, I remember saying I wanted to get it and be able to make it with my little one. And I always wanted to have one. And of course, I'd love to have one in real life, but I always wanted to have one. And it was like then, in that moment, I had to have it. So it was like, I said, well, I had a money box that I keep changing. And I said, well, I've about 50 euro now, but if you could give me 50 euro, then I could go down and buy it and everything would be fine. And she said, well, just get it for your birthday, or I'll get it for you for Christmas. And I was there, no, I have to have it now. I really want it now. And she was just kind of looking at me. And the same had happened before, I'll share that story again. But I remember that I had to have it. Like it was just this overwhelming urge. I had to have it that night. And I was down in the Smiths in Waterford within 20 minutes, even after having one bottle of beer. Like I wasn't drink driving, but you would obviously thinking like after a bottle of beer, oh, maybe I won't chance just in case. But it was that I needed, and I was making it that night. And then it was nearly like it's very like the compulsion to gamble, because the I want is there. And then once I've made it, I made it within that day and the next day. I mean, little one, we did have a nice time making, but then it was left on the shelf. And I'm just looking at it, kind of going, and now what? So now it was about the next thing and the next thing. And I'd done it before, the other example I mentioned, I'd done it before with the book that kind of I always put down that kind of changed my life, Zen and the Art of Happiness. I had a perfectly good copy of it. And when my partner was on buying stuff on Amazon, I saw that it was a hardback copy of it. And I said to her, I want that, it's tenner. And she said, sure, you already have one. Why do you want to know? I want it. And she said, why don't you wait till I'm ordering stuff that's over a certain amount so we get your free postage? No, I want it now. And it was like that, I want. So definitely with maturity, whether that's mixed in or coupled in with impulsivity or compulsivity, it's definitely an element in me. And I even felt after that night with the camper van thing that I felt very childlike even saying it, because I had the money in my account to buy it, but I wanted the easier way of doing it. I wanted her to give me half of it, and I had half of the savings. So that was me rationalizing the behavior. Well, I have it in savings and I'm not spending it on my account. So there are definitely, it definitely throws me back to when I was younger, when I always probably felt that I wanted stuff, but I probably was never in a position to be able to get it. But now I probably was in a position, but I still wanted it the easy way. I don't know if that makes sense in what we're talking about, but definitely it is a part in recovery.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. There's a great book called Willpower, which is based on the findings from the marshmallow test. I think there's another book called the marshmallow test as well, but the marshmallow test was a test, maybe you've mentioned this before, but it was done in Stanford University, and they basically just went down to the childcare area in the university, and they obviously with the permission of the parents, you would imagine, and they're working with kids who are about 4 or 5 maybe, and they basically, very simple test, put them in a room with a marshmallow or some other sweet treat and said, look, sit here on your own with this sweet treat for 15 minutes. And if you can wait 15 minutes without eating it, you get a second marshmallow or a piece of chocolate, whatever. And obviously loads of the kids cracked straight away and ate the marshmallow. And some of them, you know, could wait 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, and then they cracked and then they ate it. And a small portion of the kids were able to wait the full 15 minutes and get the reward, which is the second marshmallow, right? Which is not all that interesting in and of itself. But when they went back and talked to those people when they were adults, maybe 20, 30 years later, they found that the kids who could wait for the second marshmallow were outperforming the other ones in every single category they could look at. So they were better educated, they were less likely to have a criminal record, less likely to be overweight, less likely to be addicted to anything, less likely to be divorced. You know, they earned more money. Like every single heading that you could possibly compare them on, you know, they're less likely to have any health conditions. You name it, across the board, they were outperforming. And they realized that they had accidentally stumbled across the most effective way to predict future outcomes in children just by putting a marshmallow in front of a child for 15 minutes, right? It sounds bizarre. If you're interested in this stuff at all, check out the book Willpower. It's really, really interesting. But that, what the theory that they developed from that was that the ability to delay gratification, as in to wait until your birthday to get the camper van, or to wait until Christmas to get the camper van, or whatever the thing is, or the book, is one of the most important skills that any of us can learn at any stage in our lives. And I suppose for people in recovery, that's a big part of the learning curve, a big part of the learning process, a big part of the recovery process. And for a lot of people in recovery, they've never learned how to do that with anything in any aspect of their lives, you know. So yeah, as an indicator of maturity, I think delaying gratification is one of the big ones. I really do think it is. It's massive.
It's something I have worked on since the turn of the year, because the same thing happened at Christmas. I wanted the Defender Jeep Lego thing, and I bought it as well. And again, I had a Littlewoods account open from a while back, and I just got it on the Littlewoods account. Now this was nearly, it was nearly double the price of the other one, but I had to have it. And then as soon as I made it, I had it down in the spare room where I used to work from. And I was just looking at it, and it was absolutely huge. And I just said, "Mr., you're bloody mad." I said, "This is just stupid." So I actually wrapped it in plastic, and I actually put it up into the attic because it was annoying me. It was reminding me. And it was that moment that I changed that. Now, I don't always get it right. So like I mentioned before on the podcast about shopping, has been a thing that has crept in, especially during the pandemic or lockdown. But I had a chat. Again, I externalized. I probably talked to yourself about it. I was talking to my partner about it. And I externalized it. And then I realized that all these boys were impulsive, compulsive. They were, and again, it does link back into the maturity. Like I'm 47. Here I am going around buying Lego. Like, and there's nothing wrong with people buying Lego at any age, but I think it was more the idea of it than the reality of it. It was kind of hard to describe. It was kind of, it definitely is that I want, rather than I need. And I really started to look at that when I'm just about to make an impulse buy. I kind of stopped myself and I said, "Do you really need this, or why are you buying this?" And sometimes I've got it right probably more than not this year, but sometimes I do give into it, whether it's a new album or whether it's whatever, another book that one you mentioned with Byrne. I guess I have that and I had never read it. I had to buy it that time when I was in college, but I've never read it, and probably describes me more than anyone else. And it's the ability that I've started to learn the ability to respect money, which is mature, B, not to give in to the impulse to buy. And I think I've grown over the last couple of months. Like I'll often share with clients that I felt I've learned more about myself in the last 6 to 9 months than I have in the previous 9 to 9.5 years in recovery. So it's kind of like I think that was really a moment that I kind of went, this isn't right. You don't need to be buying this stuff. And I reframed it. So I said, like, instead of buying back, buying material things, which is definitely a coping skill I've had from childhood, instead of doing that, I'm going to try buy back time. I'm going to try save. I'm going to try put money away so that, you know, I can work less, or I can, we can go away more holidays, that you enjoy the moments, that you don't need to be a slave to buying. And definitely, I do think there's a huge overlap with me anyway, a huge overlap with that behavior and the gambling behavior. And it does come at me at times when I'm overwhelmed. It comes at me at times when I'm a bit stressed, or when I'm maybe feeling a bit insecure. And it definitely does have an impact on me, because then you go through the whole guilt, shame, that cycle, same with gambling, that guilt and shame. And then you have to repeat the behavior to make yourself feel better again. So it was a big moment to me last January or February where I did take a step back out of it. And what I've done this time is that it does happen every so often. Like I will pick up an album that maybe I, you know, sometimes I pick up an album that I might have listened to on Spotify, but I just want to have it. But I am getting better at it, and I don't beat myself up as much over it when it does happen. So I think that's probably, I probably am getting more mature now in recovery. It's only taken me 10 years, but I'm finally getting there, because my respect of money has never been there, only for the last couple of months. Even in, like, it was nearly like what you'll often hear a gambler saying, that I just had to get rid of the money. Even in recovery for the last 10 years, every time I've had money, I've had to get rid of it. And I'll justify it saying, well, you know, this has always been the way. Like, I've never saved money throughout my whole life. It's always been borrowing or getting higher purchase or paying back loans or whatever that's been. I've never had the ability to save to be able to, you know, have that, you know, kind of save and then wait and have the patience to buy something. So it's something I'm trying to change. Maybe it's too late for me at 47, but I'm still trying to change it. But I don't think it's ever too late. But it is good, because it gives me a great insight into my own recovery as well. And once I have a little bit more of understanding what's happening in the background, because it is that bridge effect back to childhood the whole time. And it happened this morning. I'm sure I'll chat about that later on. But it is to recognize what it is. You can kind of challenge how you're feeling in that and try to change within that. I don't know whether that makes sense, but
it definitely does. And the more you challenge it, the more you're kind of flexing and strengthening that metaphorical muscle. You know, you're building up resilience, and it's never too late to do the right thing. Like, I've been terrible all through my life. I've never had any interest in gambling, but I've always been pretty bad at managing money. And I suppose I'm learning. It's definitely with Revolut, you know, when they started kind of creating the little vaults in Revolut. Now I kind of separate out every month, well, X amount is going in for this thing. And, you know, a lot of vaults there for, or as they call them in this part of the world, diddlies, you know, like the Christmas diddly. There's a real Waterford thing. You start saving for Christmas in January in the credit union. And I heard that one
in a session, diddly, and I said, what the hell is a diddly? Yeah, it was, you know, I've heard it. It had to be explained to me, like the blah. It all had to be explained to me when I moved down.
Yeah, same here. We're both blow-ins here in Waterford. But yeah, it's a sensible thing. You know, start putting aside a little bit of money in January for the following Christmas, or start putting away having a holiday diddly or a little savings fund or whatever it is. It makes absolute sense. I've only really started doing stuff like that in the last couple of years, and I'm 2 years older than you, so it's never too late to do the right thing or to learn a new skill. Go on, Tony.
1 year older than me, isn't it?
I'm 49.
Yeah, two, sorry. And even within that, like, you know, we talk a lot about on the podcast or in with client work about time, access, money. What I did do was, even in kind of later recovery, when I have been managing my own money pretty much, you know, throughout recovery, bar the first couple of, you know, months or years. And what I did within that, I recognized that when there was money sitting there, because I wasn't spending as much during the lockdown, because I wasn't traveling as much. I wasn't, you know, we weren't going out. We weren't being able to socialize. What I did find, when the money was building up, that's when I would spend. And I justify it saying, I'm not going on holiday this year, or I'm not, you know, we're not going out. I need something, or I deserve this. But what I started to do was, I mentioned this the whole time to clients as well. I started to tighten the loopholes. And what I done was I when the money drops in, when I get paid, it's just, I transfer most of it to my partner. So it's all going, and she looks after the savings and all that kind of stuff. And then with the Revolut card, I do transfer enough just to keep me within the month. I have it nearly down to a T of how much I will need, so that before money drops in again the following month, I'm probably, there's probably 6 or 7 euro in one account and maybe 20 in another account. You know, the main account that I transferred to the Revolut from. And it just, what I did find that when the money was sitting there, yes, the impulsivity to spend was there, but also that led to more thoughts around gambling, because the two are intrinsically linked with me. When I'm spending money, that can lead to compulsions, because when I'm spending on that frenzy, I kind of see, well, gambling is an easier way of getting this need met quicker, because I can win more money and buy more things. So the old thinking starts to come back in. So what I done was I took away the means, so that I knew that the money was not sitting in the account like Father Ted. It was only resting in my account. I made the decision January, February, that I'm going to try to look at this with the money management. And but what I did do is I started taking actions. And that was a big thing for me, to be totally open and honest with, you know, where each bit of money is going. And again, that for me, that was a bit maturity, because before that, you're always holding a little bit back. You know, you're always maybe having 100 euro, 200 euro to the side for the just in cases, or the slush funds, as we used to call them back when I was young. That, but I think there definitely is a shift in me in the last couple of months, which is, it's refreshing, as you said, to think that even, you know, you look at 10 years in recovery and you kind of say, well, yeah, I haven't gambled in 10 years, but you're still constantly learning around this and still constantly trying to make those changes to improve your life, to improve that thinking, so that you're not a slave to the things that can be linked to gambling, such as money. And I have been a slave to money all my life because my relationship with it has been absolutely horrendous, but getting better and better. And that's what recovery is. It's not always that linear. You start and you end up, you know, riding off into the sunset, everything's perfect. It is a journey. There's obstacles, there's learning, there's setbacks. And for me, there's been huge learning in the last couple of months.
Yeah, and I think we were saying that the last day with Steve from GamFam, you know, every day is a school day. And, you know, we're talking about the idea of the little chimp part of our brain, which is that very kind of emotional, reactionary, knee-jerk reaction part, you know, and, you know, reacting to stimuli. And sometimes the stimuli are external, sometimes they're internal, sometimes it's a combination of both. And yeah, it's funny, I listen to the Sarah Silverman podcast sometimes, and she said it a couple of times, her shrink, her therapist, has a catchphrase that if it's hysterical, it's historical. You know, so if you're having an emotional, hysterical is kind of a loaded word, but if you're having an emotional reaction to something, it's probably going way, way back. You know, I don't do it too much in therapy, kind of go digging around in people's childhoods, but it often comes up anyway because it wants to come out, you know. And the stuff that happens to us in our childhoods impacts on the way we think and the way we behave in adulthood. If we can leave it kind of unexamined, and, you know, it remains subconscious, remains unconscious, and it can drive a lot of our behaviors. And I suppose we were said starting out that we'd have a look at the idea of transactional analysis. That childhood stuff is a big part of that. We can't separate out who we are today from the experiences we had as children, because we were being programmed and taught about how the world works as children, you know. So, I mean, if I give the example, if there are any children nearby, please, I hope, you know, if you're listening to this on a speaker and there are children nearby, just kick them out of the room for a minute. So if I tell a child that there's a magical fat man in a red suit that comes down the chimney on the night of every 24th of December, going into 25th of December, and leaves lots of presents around, a child is going to believe that, right? They're going to believe that. They're going to take it as fact, because on Christmas morning, they will see that there are presents under the tree, and maybe Rudolph has eaten a bit of the carrot that you left out for him, and Santa Claus has eaten a few cookies and drunk a bit of milk, or Guinness if you're in Ireland. And there you go, ipso facto, proof positive that Santa Claus exists to the mind of a child, right? So children are very, very programmable and very, very prone to brainwashing, right? And the Santa Claus equivalent of brainwashing is very overt. It's a deliberate form of brainwashing, and we all buy into this story, and it's very fun for kids. And at some point, some kid in the schoolyard is going to tell them what the real story is, and they'll be sad for a few days and the bubble will be burst. But that's the overt, deliberate brainwashing. Then we have the accidental brainwashing, which we're doing all the time, right? We're doing it all the time. And for a lot of people, the accidental brainwashing that happens is probably the most common one that I've come across in therapy, is the person feels less than, right? So they've been brainwashed as a child, accidentally usually, into believing that they are less than, that they have less value than other people, right? And at no point in their life does some child in the schoolyard come along and say, oh no, that was just a trick that your parents played on you. You're just the same as everybody else. That conversation never happens. So people can go through their entire lives believing that thing that they were accidentally brainwashed into believing as a child, right? Am I making sense so far, Tony, or am I going way too off the reservation here?
I'm in a sad mode because I didn't know about Santa, but no, I'm only messing. No, definitely no. You're making sense, brilliant.
Okay, so with that in mind, we have the concept of transactional analysis. If you're interested in this at all, go buy the book Games People Play. It's very, very interesting. It's an easy read and it goes into much more depth in that. But I'll break it down the simplest way I possibly can. And the first time I came across this was before I ever had any desire to become a counsellor or before I started training as a counsellor. I was working for DHL, the delivery service, in a kind of admin role. And I got given this job of training my co-workers on how to deal with angry customers, right? How to dial things down when you had a really angry customer. We were dealing with key account customers who would be spending millions with DHL. So it was important that we could manage people who are upset and angry and try and get the conversation into a less hysterical place, for want of a better word, right? So the way DHL used it was that they would look at the three modes as defined by Eric Byrne within transactional analysis. You have the parent mode, which is a parent as remembered from the perspective of a child. So what does a parent mean to a small child? A parent is the authoritarian. Sometimes they're the judge. They're the one who tells you what you should do and what you must not do. So there's lots of shoulds and musts. There can be judgment in there. They're setting the rules, right? So that is the parent mode, is the parent from the perspective of a child, as remembered by a child. It's that kind of finger wagging, don't do this, do that, you must do this, you shouldn't do that, you know, and they're setting the rules and they're setting the parameters for what, how to behave in the world, right? Which is part of the, I suppose, the deliberate programming that we do with our children, right? Again, most parents are doing this from a good place. Then you have the child mode, which is just what it's like to be a child. You're helpless. You don't know how to solve problems. You don't know how to be responsible for anything. You don't know how to cope with situations because you're a child. You're helpless. You need other people to do things for you, and you need other people to take responsibility for things for you, because as a child, you can't do that. As a small child, you can't do that yet, right? So the child is kind of helpless. The parent, in some ways, is the person who sets the rules, who's authoritative sometimes and authoritarian sometimes, and sometimes can be judgmental or critical. Again, this, I'm not bashing parents here, but this can be from the perception of a small child, right? So you have those two extremes, helplessness on one extreme, inability to cope and solve problems. And then on the other end, you can have this very kind of authoritarian sometimes, or authoritative person who gets to make the decisions, set the rules, make the judgments and set the values. And then in the middle, you've got, which is the ideal mode, according to Eric Byrne, is adult mode, right? So, and that is where we're being kind of rational, and we can weigh up the pros and cons of a decision, and we think through our behaviors rather than a knee-jerk reaction, or, you know, let's say from a very emotive child mode, or from, let's say, a very kind of quick to judge parent mode, right? So they're the three modes. And if we have two people in conversation, in a dialogue or a transaction, as Eric Byrne would call it, ideally what we want is adult to adult. That's the best, most effective way for two people to communicate. Now, very, very often, let's say I'm working in customer service for DHL, or, you know, I worked in bars and restaurants and hospitality for a long time as well. You will have somebody starting a transaction or a conversation with you in, let's say, parent mode. So they're angry, they're finger wagging, they're complaining about the service and this is terrible, and they're very emotive and judgmental, and they're giving out to you basically. Now you can come back at them in parent mode, right, and start wagging your finger at them and saying, well, listen, it's blah 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 blah, it's your fault, and if you've done this and if you've done that. And that's what they call a crossed transaction. It's unhealthy, it's unhelpful, it's not going to get anybody anywhere. You've just got two people shouting at each other. Or alternatively, I could respond to the person in child mode where I present as helpless and I don't know how to help them solve the problem that they have. And again, that can be a dynamic sometimes in, let's say, romantic relationships, where somebody takes on the parental type role and somebody takes on the helpless role. And in romantic relationships, that can go on for years and years. That can go on for the entire duration of the relationship sometimes. And it functions, you know, but it's not particularly healthy, right? Because the person in the parent mode ends up resenting having to take responsibility for everything all the time. And the person in the child mode, you know, has this kind of learned helplessness, which is not healthy for them or for the other person or the dynamic in the relationship. So, I mean, in the context of DHL, what we were trying to do is encourage the conversation and, I suppose, nudge people. It was kind of, I suppose, a form of a manipulation in the work context, is to nudge the other person into communicating with you on an adult-to-adult mode. And there are lots of kind of tricks of the trade around that that aren't particularly helpful in the context of this podcast. But you've got the three modes: parent, adult, child. The ideal mode of communication is adult to adult. And quite often we end up in cross communication. So if you've got child to child, we've got two helpless people, the sub problem is not going to get solved in that way. If you've got parent to parent, we've got two people wagging fingers at each other and assigning blame to each other, that's not going to solve the problem either. Ideally, it's adult to adult. And if I give an example that I'd often give it in counseling sessions, let's say one person walks in the door and they say to their partner, "Oh, have you seen my jacket?" Right? And the partner then has two options to reply in that situation. They could say, "Well, if you hung your jacket up in the hallway, like a decent human being, you'd know where your jacket was." That's one option. And anybody who's ever been in a relationship with anybody knows sometimes that that can be that kind of response that you get in that situation. It's loaded with baggage because you've had arguments about, you know, where the coat should be hung up in the past, and you're breaking the rules, or the, you know, your partner is pissed off with you about some totally different thing and they're having to dig at you about the jacket. That's not adult to adult communication, right? So the person walks into the room as an adult, they're asking a very simple question: "Have you seen my coat?" Right? So an adult response to that situation might be, "No, I haven't. So I haven't seen your coat," or, "Your coat is on the back of the chair in the kitchen." Right? That's an adult to adult conversation. You're talking about what's actually going on in the moment rather than dragging in baggage from the past to turn it into something else. And ideally, that's what you're working towards in, I suppose, mature interactions with other people. And then as an internal process, if we're talking to ourselves, adult to adult, that's much healthier as well. Because quite often we have the inner critic in our minds, which is the finger wagging, you're not worthy, you're a bad person, it's too late to do anything about this problem, you'll never amount to anything. You know, all the replaying a lot of the stuff that maybe not necessarily just parents, but it could be teachers or other important caregivers might have said to us as a child. And that inner critic is like that parent mode in our head. Or we can flip to the other way into child mode, where it's like, there's a problem. I can't possibly deal with it. I can't cope with this. I can't cope. And of course, then we go to our coping mechanism of choice. Could be gambling, alcohol, food, you name it. You know? So it can be an internal process as well as an external process in terms of how we interact with other people. Am I making sense so far, Tony?
Yeah, totally. And maybe just to add to that, like that internal conversation is definitely one that happens like when a compulsion comes, because as I said earlier on, the I want is, if you can describe that as the child, like, and then the adult saying, you know, you shouldn't be gambling, like if you gamble this will happen. And there's that inner conflict. You're not able to go into adult mode with yourself because you're so overwhelmed. And like it's a word that came up a lot this week in different sessions, that feeling of being overwhelmed. When you were overwhelmed from your internal or external trigger, you can't rationalize that conversation. So if you're looking at, you know, a bit we would work on a lot with clients would be internal and external triggers. So when we are triggered, it's very difficult to have that adult to adult conversation with yourself, because you're not, again, to go back to what Steve was saying last week, you go into the chimp mode goes in and there's no rationalization there, and you'll feed into whichever one is probably the easier. So I feel when in that moment you might feed into the child, the example I used earlier on, you'll feed into that bit because that's the path of easiest or least resistance, or the easiest path. And so that when you were even saying that, it's the ability. And it's like in an argument, like if you have two adults having an argument in that moment, you're so overwhelmed within it that you will say things. You'll bring up arguments from 4 years, 3 days and 2 weeks ago, or you'll bring up different things. And it's only when you take a step back out of it that you come back. When you're not as overwhelmed, you come back, then you can have the adult-to-adult conversation. So that's nearly the same with a compulsion, I think, is that in that moment, you're so overwhelmed by the I want to gamble that you're not able to have those rational conversations. And that's when I believe relapse or lapses can happen within that. So it's very important, to have skills, as we will always talk about with clients, skills to be able to recognize that. And I think Steve put it brilliantly last week. He said, press that emotional pause button and have the ability to take ourselves out of that for a second and have that adult conversation. As I said, you won't always get it right, but it's so important in relapse prevention to have the ability to do that so you can get it right, because otherwise the whole thing starts ash affecting them after I'm after starting, I might as well stay going at it. So yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking when you were chatting around that, whether that's the right kind of way to be thinking around it as well.
Yeah, no, I think you're hitting the nail on the head there. And that internal thing, I think, is a huge part of it that we probably don't focus on enough. And, even I'm just thinking as you're talking there, a lot of the people that would contact us are family members. And part of that kind of parent mode to helpless child mode, a lot of them are parents of adults, right, with gambling problems. And the parent mode is quite often jumping in to help someone who needs to learn how to help themselves. Like, so they're inadvertently, with good intentions, like we were talking about with Steve last week, keeping the person with the gambling problem in child mode and not allowing them to ascend or mature into adult mode. Now, they're not doing that deliberately. They're not doing that with any bad intention. Any parents or family members listening to this, we know that is not the case. They're doing it from a good place, but that can be the dynamic, And, it's amazing. I would recommend, I know you have so many books around the place, Tony, but if you ever get a chance to read that book, Games People Play, because once you start looking at your own thought processes internally and your own interactions with other people through the prism of parent, adult, child, like, what's the dynamic here? How am I communicating with this other person? Now, we can't, much as I'm sure DHL and other corporations would like to think that we can manipulate people into always speaking to us in adult to adult, there may be kind of a few nudges that you can make there, but realistically, all you can manage is your own stuff. All you can control is the controllables, which is what you're doing, right? So if you're making your best efforts to communicate with other people from that adult place, that kind of rational place where you're taking a moment, you're pressing the emotional pause button rather than replying to them with a knee-jerk emotional reaction, you take a beat, you take a breath, you go, okay, I'm going to take a moment to process what that person says, and I'm going to reply from the most rational place I can, right? Rather than going, well, I might have, gambled, or I might have, done X, Y, and Z, or bought a camper van, but you did that thing 5 years ago. And now we're into the same old psychodrama, round and round and round and round. That helps nobody. There are no winners in that situation, right? Yeah. If you can say, you're right, I gambled, I lied about it. I'm going to put my hands up. I'm going to be the adult here. Try and make amends or whatever the situation is, to rather than knee-jerk reaction, defensive mode, and lashing out at the other person. Then you're just stuck in that indefinitely. Sorry, Tony, you wanted to say
something. Yeah, no, just and again, it, as I always said, it's that's all easy in theory, but the human condition brings you back into that mode. It's like that bridge effect when you're triggered, that it brings you right back to maybe the 10-year-old child reaction, because maybe it's the same feelings are coming up. And that's why it's so important to recognize that, that it's just that what it is. Yeah, I just when you were talking about the adult child and parent, like I remember I actually have read most of the book. I think I remember doing it through college, but like everything else, it went in one ear with me and out the other, so I'll have to revisit it. But definitely I would have done a piece in I think it was first year in college when we were doing Freud, and it was like the eight, the superego and the ego, and it was very much based on that as well. Like the superego would be kind of like society, isn't it? The ego then would be the parent mode, we'll say, and then the id would be the child mode. So it's very similar kind of ideas with it. And I really kind of made the connection that when we're gambling, well, I felt when I was gambling, I was very much in the id or the child mode, because it was like I couldn't, you know, it was very much like, as I know I've said the phrase a lot today, but is that I want, or I need. And it's when I was gambling, I was right back in that mode. I couldn't look at the bigger picture because I was stuck in it, because I had to try fix the situation I was in. Like how many times as a child you'll try, you might break something, and instead of going to the parents, you might try put it together back together with glue. And you see it in cartoons. But the example that really hits home for me with that is the when I was younger, I fancied myself as a bit of an electrician. So for some reason, hopefully health and safety won't come down on my father on this. For some reason, my father had a lamp connected straight up into the socket, wired straight in. Of course, I was with these little them little screwdrivers, the old silver ones like this kind of, and I was messing around and I blew myself back across the room. Now, I could have killed myself. And I'm sitting there on the bed kind of going, oh shit, I'm in trouble now. I can't say this. So I just pushed the lamp back in and I put a chair in front of it, and I didn't tell him for about 3 years. I was only one time, probably a little bit on, was only one time. And another thing happened as well. My sister was annoying me, and I ended up slamming the door, and the door handle went through the plasterboard, and I just covered that up with a poster. And I didn't tell anyone for 3 years, it's 3 or 4 years. And it was only one day he was up doing something in the attic, and I knew more about electricity at this time and stuff like that. If you turn off the trip switch, you can do stuff. And I just said, oh, by the way, while you're up there, this happened years ago, and would you mind sorting that out? And he just went in, clipped it, unscrewed it, took out the yoke, and said, why didn't you tell me? And was like, and I said, oh yeah, by the way, while you're at it, I just pulled up the poster and said, I done that a few years ago as well. But it definitely was that the shame, but definitely, and the guilt or the worry, the childlike worry, oh, I'm going to get in trouble here. And like, my father would be the most easy man in the world, but it's like that your internal kind of process in that I'm going to get in trouble here if I say anything. And from that, it was just, I held that for years. And then, it was sorted out within a couple of minutes. And that can happen to me at times. And I even mentioned that before we got on, we won't go into it fully, but I mentioned that beforehand, like that kind of happened me this morning when I went into that child mode, I'm going to get in trouble for something, you know. And then it was very much like my head went, it was like kind of, and I very much went into child thinking mode. I couldn't come back to the adults, or the parent thinking, or the adult thinking, because it kept coming back at me. It was only when I had a conversation with yourself that it settled me. And we had a very adult conversation, and now it's gone. It's after gone. But that happens me so many times during the week, so many times during the month, that I go back to that child. So again, from today, there was even more realization in my own kind of recovery and my own processing, means of processing, that I need to maybe go back and look at that as well. And again, it was a bit of a revelation this morning before we got on to the podcast, but it's good because you can really start questioning, why am I reacting this way? Is this kind of equal to what I'm reacting about? And then if you can, again, pull back from that and really process that or really look at that, then you can come back to it a few minutes later and say, you know what, I'm after making such a big deal out of that. But that can be so overwhelming in that moment that that's when you go back into old behaviors and kind of old ways of coping, because that's the kind of condition that we have from back then.
Yeah, and it is that learned helplessness, the learned behavior, the knee-jerk reaction. And I suppose You mentioned Freud earlier on. I mean, he gets a lot of bad press. I suppose he was the originator. So, I mean, a lot, you know, a lot of the stuff doesn't really kind of carry through now. But I suppose one of the things that he did say that I think still rings true is that the purpose of therapy is to bring the unconscious into consciousness. Because if we're caught in a loop of unconscious habits that we are left unexamined, we don't think about why we're doing them, that can just go on forever. You know, it could be gambling, it could be how we respond to conflict, you know, how we respond to stress, you name it, across the board. And if you leave that stuff unexamined, that loop is just going to continue and in many cases just get progressively worse. So we need to sometimes take time out in our lives to say, oh, hang on a second, where is this coming from? Why do I keep having the same knee-jerk reaction? Can I respond differently, you know, in these types of situations? And we can, we absolutely can. And we started out at the top of this podcast talking about this idea of maturity, adulting, emotional maturity that Gamblers Anonymous talk about. And there's a list here. I thought before we finish up, we might go through today, because I think a lot of this describes that adult mode of thinking and behaving and responding both internally and externally in our communications with ourselves and with other people. I think it describes a lot of that in a really, really useful way. So we might just jump into that, if that's okay, Tony. Yeah, because I know we need to get back to our days as well. So the first one in this list is that we accept criticism gratefully, being honestly grateful for any opportunity to improve. Now, the child mode is not going to like that at all. And even the parent mode isn't going to like it, because the parent mode kind of thinks it knows everything, right? And it thinks it has everything sourced, and it is not going to accept criticism gratefully. That's very much an adult, mature, emotionally mature way of dealing with criticism. What do you think about that?
Definitely something that has improved in me during recovery. But sometimes, as I was saying about the situation earlier, sometimes you can go back. It depends on what the criticism. It may be sometimes you feel if you're being criticized about a certain thing, like someone could say, yeah, Tony, you're overweight, or I'm okay with that nowadays because I kind of accepted that I am and I need to lose a few pounds. That's fine. But if someone criticized something that maybe I don't see him accept, like that blind spot, you know, the Johari window, or Jung talks about that blind spots. If I don't see it in myself, or I don't see it as something that's an issue with me, being criticized sometimes can bring you back into old ways of thinking. I think it's good to kind of reframe it. And it really does it well there. It says being honestly grateful for an opportunity to improve. So you look at, well, it's not a criticism, it's a way that I can improve myself going forward. So I think there's definitely a lot of maturity comes with that as well. The ability to be able to take what's said and kind of reframe it and use it to your advantage. Or I don't know if advantage is the right word, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is to your advantage because it's helping you to improve. Now, some criticism is unfounded and unhelpful. And I suppose it's important to say that some people are just having a pop off you. But it's, I suppose, part of maturity is being able to discern when those things are somebody saying, look, pal, and they're giving you some constructive feedback or criticism in a helpful way, you know, rather than a knee-jerk, you know, reaction either from child mode or parent mode. It's healthier and more mature to be able to say, okay, thank you for that criticism. It can be hard to hear, but it's going to help your development as a person and your maturity.
Yeah, I think the inner critic is probably the biggest one, isn't it? Your inner critic is the one that resonates most, because you against your own thinking. Again, it's like that child, adult, you just, when that inner critic kicks in, it's very hard to be grateful for an opportunity to improve. You kind of really have to kind of process that and pull that apart and see where that's coming from as well. So it's, even though it's the first one of 16 that's on the list, it's a hugely important one and one that we have to really work on. And it takes a certain amount of, you know, it takes a lot of personal development to kind of be able to kind of look at things that we don't like about ourselves and say, right, I can sit with this or I can change it. Like I'm listening to David Goggins' book at the moment, and he's a brilliant way of describing it. Like I advise anyone to have a listen to it. And he just says, like, you look in the mirror and you see that you're fat, just stop eating, just do this. And it kind of like, you know, like, don't give out about it, don't bitch about it, just do it. And like, I think sometimes, as you said, sometimes we need to hear that. Like sometimes we kind of, ah, well, yeah, I don't have time, or I'm too busy, or I'm this or that. And I think it's something I need to hear, because I'll be the one who'll be that, the procrastinator, jumping, ah, yeah, I could do that, but I should be doing this, but. And I talk about not using the word shoulds and shouldn'ts or couldn'ts in therapy, but I'm probably the worst in the world for using one myself, that inner critic. Oh yeah, you're big, you know, I know you should do this, but there's the excuse. And he says, stop using excuses, just get on. And it really is. It's probably what I needed at the time, to hear that kind of voice telling my own internal voice, shut up and just do something about it, you know. And it was funny, because I talk about weight a lot. Like, I know I need to lose a few pounds, and I want, and I should, and all this kind of stuff. And I was looking back through my Coon Vera book from 10 years ago, and I was saying the same thing 10 years ago. Yeah, I when I get out, I'd like to lose a bit of weight and eat more healthy. And 10 years on, I'm still saying the same thing. So my own internal voice, I need to challenge that, and maybe that inner critic. I wouldn't even say it's even inner critic. Maybe I just need to kind of say, stop talking about it and just start doing. And that's what David Goggins would say, just stop talking about it, just do.
There's a lot in that. I'd love to do a podcast episode on the word should, because it's my pet peeve.
Well, same as, but it's something that I would probably use internally without realizing it. Then I'd be always saying in sessions, kind of like, take the word should and shouldn't out. And then I'd always say, yeah, make sure you look at self-care. But then I'm probably the worst in the world at self-care at times. I'm getting better again. But it's just, it really is like, it's kind of, it's that ability, I think, to be able to take that step back and kind of really look at everything holistically. But I suppose with criticism, it's, I think, with anyone who's in recovery or who's maybe still gambling, I think that inner critic is the one, because you keep coming back to the guilt and shame. And that's where I always come back to when I'm triggered by certain things, is the guilt and shame of what I've done, of how I affected people, of maybe potentially how I might have affected other people in the future. And you come back to that. And I'm very critical of myself for that. But then I have to think, like, I didn't set out to become a compulsive gambler. It wasn't that I'd done this. It's just that something that I fell into, or something that happened. But now I can do something about that. And that's what I tried to do. And that's maybe that's a little bit more mature thinking, rather than it kind of it leads into this, to the second point. Maybe that self-pity can come in every so often as well. And that can drive certain types of thinking and behaving as well.
Yeah, let's jump onto that second one. We'll come back to should another day, because that deserves a better
be hour. I think it'd be a good one to do. Shoulda, coulda,
woulda. Okay, so the second one is, we do not indulge in self-pity and have begun to feel the laws of compensation operating in all life. I'm not sure what the laws of compensation, but let's look at the self-pity bit there. We don't indulge in self-pity. I mean, self-pity is like, who benefits from that? Like, what's wallowing in self-pity? What's the end game there? Like, benefiting from that?
I think in the moment, and maybe it's a comforting, and maybe it's an old comforting skill that we've learned, that self-pity thing. That self-pity thing, even saying it. It's something that I fall into it every so often. I think everyone does. As again, it doesn't benefit anyone, but I think maybe it's a comfort blanket that when I'm there, maybe it's what we done when we were younger. It's maybe it was a coping skill when we were younger, when we didn't get our own way. And maybe that, you know, again, you shake yourself out of that as young, but sometimes I think there is that bridge effect from childhood ways of coping and adult ways of coping. Maybe that's what it is. That would be my understanding. I don't know what the laws of compensation operate on it.
Maybe the laws of compensation mean that, you know, sometimes good things are going to happen to you, and sometimes to compensate for that, bad things are going to happen to you. Maybe I'm just guessing here, but I mean, you know, child mode, can self-pity can definitely link in with that, where it's that kind of helplessness and why me, and why are these things happening to me, and I have no control over anything that happens, except of course you can't control the controllables. And then also there can be self-pity on the parent side as well, where, you know, why am I stuck with all of this responsibility? You know, whereas if we're in that mature adult mode, we accept that sometimes bad things are going to happen, sometimes good things are going to happen. You know, the Stoic philosophy that underpins a lot, basically the ideas behind cognitive behavioral therapy, would say that there are no good situations or bad situations. they're just situations, right? And then we project our value judgments onto them, saying, well, this situation is good because, or this situation is bad because. And then we can get wrapped up in all of that. We'll crack on with the next one. We do not expect special consideration from anyone.
Ooh.
I suppose both the child and the parent mode do expect those things. You know, the parent mode can be like, look at me, I'm doing all the things and I'm taking all the responsibility and setting all the rules and I'm special. And then obviously from the child mode, we feel that we need to be taken care of and we expect special consideration. Am I making sense there?
I don't know if that makes sense to me. I don't know. We don't expect special consideration from anyone. I don't know if that, I'd have probably to take a step back and I would think about that one, I think. Because I think we should expect some kind of special consideration, you know, or, you know, what does special consideration involve? Is it respect, love? What is it? I think I'd have to probably pull that one apart further. Maybe we might come back to that in another episode, but,
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a sense of entitlement that I'm entitled to.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, and so that isn't a particularly healthy or mature mindset.
Maybe said I'm entitled to win my money back. Like, I think, like, we had Jodie Bechtold on, and in her book, she's a great way of describing it. I use in presentations now that, you know, if you have a nice meal or go to a good concert or, you know, go to the cinema to see a good film, you don't expect your money back on the way out the door. But sometimes we have this expectation or God-given right that every time we place a bet, we should be winning. And that's when it moves away from what it's packaged up as, this entertainment versus. So maybe that's a personality thing, that we expect special consideration, that I deserve to win this because I've lost so many, or I deserve to win this because that team let me down the last time. And maybe that's where the cognitive bit comes in and has a part to play in that, maybe.
Yeah, and most people who fall into the trap of developing a gambling problem, they have some big win early on. They think, this is easy. I'm not one of these mugs who's losing all their money every week. I'm special. I'm different. I have skills around this. You know, I'm special and I deserve special consideration in some way. Or we've spoken before about Kenny Alexander, the former CEO of Ladbrokes Coral, saying that 99% of their online accounts were losing accounts. And of course, everybody listening to that would go, well, I'm in the 1%, even though a 10 second look at their online account would prove that they're definitely not in the 1%. Yeah, so there might be something in that. The next one is we control our temper. And I suppose if we're in adult mode, we are controlling our temper. We're able to hit the emotional pause button. We're able to take a moment, you know, we're able to accept the criticism, or we're able to accept that the person who's communicating with us is doing so from parent mode or child mode for whatever variety of reasons. And we're able to respond calmly rather than a knee-jerk angry reaction. Any thoughts on that?
Not easy all the time, but I think that is a big part in recovery, the ability to be able to recognize when you're drifting outside of that window of tolerance and you're going to become overwhelmed. And then it's the ability just to recognize that and have things in place, like plans in place to kind of let off the pressure cooker, I suppose, as such. And that's the ability to be able to have conversations and talk about what's going on. And that's why meetings are so important, counseling sessions, exercise, activities. It does kind of, you're being very proactive in not getting overwhelmed when that temper can really come in. And that's my proper experience of that.
Yeah, it is a really important one. I mean, and the next one I think links in with that, like, you know, that anybody I've worked with around anger management, it's really been around stress management, because if your stress levels are up around an 8 or a 9, the tiniest little thing is going to push you into a 10, which is then either explosive anger for some people, or it's just meltdown and anxiety, panic attacks for others. But yeah, the next one is we meet emergencies with poise, which is definitely easier said than done. But I suppose it's easier to manage an emergency with poise or some degree of poise if we're working on trying to be in adult mode as much as we possibly can. Because if we're in child mode, we're not going to be dealing with an emergency. We're helpless. Like, we are literally metaphorically helpless if we're in child mode. And parent mode, I suppose, because it is coming from a child's memories and a child's perception of what being an adult is, it can be very limited to the kind of shoulds and musts and rules that were set for us by adults as children. So we end up with a very narrow view of how to solve problems rather than being able to look at a problem or an emergency with an open mind. So either, you know, parent or child can be a problem, I think, in an emergency.
Yeah, I think to add to that, I think with the, like, what came to mind when you're saying we meet emergency with boys, like, you know, you have a child that goes outside and runs around and falls and cuts their knee and they come into you. You've had experience of having gone through that. You're an older, you know, you're an adult. So when the child comes in, you comfort them and say it's going to be okay. It might sting for a while. You kind of put a plaster on it, clean it out, put a plaster on it. And you meet the emergency with more poise because you've been through there, because you know that, you know, what's going to happen, where the child in that moment thinks that my leg is going to fall off, you know, or it's never going to stop bleeding. And I think the example I always use with meet emergency with poise is the whole example of a fire drill. Now, if a fire goes on, you know, we start to see smoke in the office, or if we haven't been prepared for that emergency, we'll run around with our arms in the air and we'll be grabbing fire extinguishers and probably putting our hands on the black bit where the carbon is and burning ourselves with the freezing, burn ourselves with the coal. What the kind of flip side of that is, if we prepare for that by doing fire drills, by really getting into our head what happens when this emergency occurs, you go into that autopilot place of you automatically will walk out a certain door, go to a point A, and you'll ring the emergency services, you know, at whatever point you're supposed to ring them in that kind of chain of events. But if we're prepared for that, we can meet these emergencies with more poise than if we're not prepared for it. So if you look at, again, we go back to internal and external triggers for gambling. If we have a plan in place, which is very cognitive behavioral therapy stuff, if we have a plan in place or a coping skill in that specific moment, when this situation occurs, we automatically go into the autopilot of, this is what I need to do not to place that bet. Whereas before, if we haven't done that training or that, or had that realization, we'll go into the autopilot of kind of going towards the behavior that would have caused this problem in the first place.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. So like, it's that thing of, I suppose, you know, you're talking about the fire drill, that's developing competence through practice. And I suppose we only develop competence through practice. Well, first of all, you have to do the things, which means you have to do some adulting and actually engage in things rather than having other people do things for you all the time. And, you know, through that process, you develop a competence and comfort around it. And the thing that was previously outside your comfort zone is now within your comfort zone. So definitely agree with you 100% there. The next one is, our feelings are not easily hurt. I think that's a big one, you know, in relationships, is back to the transactional analysis stuff, or, you know, or even the first one about the criticism that if someone says something that we deem to be hurtful, we put that's part of our value judgment, that we decide that particular thing that the person said is hurtful to us. We're much more likely to get dragged into either child mode or parent mode and react from that place. Whereas if we can say, okay, well, that is the opinion of the other person, or the other person appears to be operating from child mode at the moment or parent mode at the moment, and if we can see it through the prism of that, I think it's a more mature, a more adult way of dealing with it, rather than, you pushed my buttons and you hurt my feelings and you did this to me. No, I can't hurt your feelings. I literally cannot hurt your feelings. I could hurt your hand if I hit it with a hammer. That is true. I could do that, right? But I cannot hurt another person's feelings deliberately. Like, I can't make that happen. That's an internal process, right? And that's one of the controllables that we can control, right? If we're in a mature, emotionally mature and emotionally stable enough place to do that, we can say, okay, well, look, that's your opinion. I disagree with you. Thanks for your input. Please fuck off. Excuse my French. And I suppose we worked a lot as bartenders and I got a hell of a lot of abuse of mostly drunk people. And I suppose I developed a thick skin around that long before I knew anything about the psychology of it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the bartender bit, as you know, I worked in as well. So it kind of, it is that you do develop a thick skin. But I suppose when you were talking, I was thinking about when I told the story publicly 3 and a bit years ago, you know, you're bringing it back out to the public domain. So you're going to get a certain amount of people will have empathy towards you or will understand it. But then you're going to have a, you know, certain cohort of people will kind of tell you what their opinion of it, and usually behind an avatar on a screen. So I suppose at the start I would have been, again, like you'll often hear, like you get 9 compliments and 1 criticism, you'll focus on the criticism because that's what most of us do. So I had to, what I've done with that was I really was able to step back out and kind of say, well, you know what? It's only one person's opinion. Do I really give a shit about what they think about me? It's only the people that are close to me that kind of are really relevant in my life. But it's very difficult to kind of be able to, as you said, not get overwhelmed in that moment and go back to a childlike thinking. You have to kind of really, I suppose, again, it's just about being in a really good place yourself to be able to deal with when your feelings can be hurt. If you're overwhelmed, or if you're kind of, as you said, you're at that 9 or a 10, same way with anger. If you're at 9 or 10 where you're feeling vulnerable, so that one thing could just drive you over the edge as well. So it all comes back to, and I use the word a lot in sessions as well, it all comes back to balance, making sure we have that balance in our lives, that we're not constantly at that 9 or a 10 or at that 1 or a 2 where we can either switch off or usually go into ourselves within anxiety or depression. So I think it is a good one. Our feelings are not easily hurt. I would say I have a relatively thick skin now, but at some time, certain situations, your feelings will be hurt because you mightn't feel validated. You mightn't feel heard, or you might feel, and that can lead to frustration, which leads to anger, which leads to kind of compulsions, so it's a fairly loaded one. And again, it looks really good on paper. Yeah, our feelings are not easily hurt. Let's just box that one off. Yeah. But in reality, it's never like that, because we will get triggered each and every day by different people, different situations. But it's the ability to take a step back from it, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, I think it's important to note, maybe we should have noted this at the start. So anybody who's dropped out of this, apologies. It's important to note that this is aspirational. Right? I don't think there's anybody out there who lives their lives like this 100% of the time. Like maybe the Dalai Lama, maybe. You know, and if you can spend, you know, most of your waking hours meditating, fair play to you. You know, that's great. This is aspirational stuff. It's stuff to work towards, right? To maybe get a little bit closer to, I think, right? Nobody's, yeah. I don't think anybody's living their lives like this 100% of the time.
Yeah, but also, I'm sorry, just to add that part, I think it's aspirational, but it's also, I think I mentioned earlier on that you try to live your best life, but it's okay if you don't live your best life in a certain moment. It's okay not to be okay in that moment. And to kind of have, I think the big word there is to have compassion towards yourself when you don't get it right in this moment. You might lose your temper. You might feel sorry for yourself and indulge in self-pity. I done it myself a couple of weeks ago. But it's okay to feel that way, because you're aware of it, but you're also, you have the ability to come back, like bounce back to your original, you know, your best self. It's okay to kind of lose your way every so often. But I suppose the bottom line in recovery is, have enough things in place so it doesn't lead back to the behavior that can just derail everything. Yeah, it is aspiration. It's like the Maslow's triangle and Roger's self-actualization and all that jazz. It is all that we aspire to be the best version of ourselves. We won't always get right, but once we're always constantly moving forward and trying to learn, trying to change, I think that's all any of us can do.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're not currently achieving these things, just take it from me that I most definitely am not either. And I'm conscious of the time here. So we're only, okay, do maybe 2 more and then we'll be halfway through the list and I'll let people read the rest of the list themselves, because there's a lot in this and, you know, don't be blowing the heads off people. But the next one is, we accept the responsibility of our own acts. Like, this is, you know, a key element of maturity, I think. You know, we're not putting stuff out there. We're not saying you made me do this or you made me do that. Or even, you know, we often have a pop off the gambling industry and they, you know, do play a role in encouraging addiction. Absolutely. And at the same time, everybody who's ever become addicted to anything has to take responsibility for their part in that, their choices, their actions, their behaviors, and the consequences of those behaviors. And ultimately, I think for anybody in recovery or anybody who's trying to achieve a degree of maturity in their life, whatever the situation is, we have to take responsibility for our own acts, for controlling the controllables, the things that we are in charge of, or that we can actually take some responsibility for. Briefly, Tony, on that.
Yeah, it's a big part of my recovery, taking responsibility for my part of it. I know it came to light over the weekend at Paddy Power. I paid the money back on post, and people were saying, oh, you know, you get some messages from friends and colleagues, well, not you, saying that, you shouldn't have had a prison sentence then. But I said, no, well, I done wrong. I still deserve to get punished for what I done, because there's consequence to the action. I did steal money, regardless of whether it was paid back afterwards. So then that definitely is, like, I think for me, that's been a really important part of my recovery, taking that responsibility. It's up to other people if they want to take responsibility for their part in it. But for me in recovery, I have to take that responsibility.
Yeah, no, that absolutely hit the nail on the head there. The last one before we finish up, and I'll post the link to this full list in the podcast description, episode description. We've outgrown the all or nothing stage. Again, that's a very important part of cognitive behavioral therapy. All or nothing thinking is considered an unhelpful thinking style, and that kind of black and white binary thinking, which social media certainly seems to encourage big time. We've outgrown that stage, recognizing that no person or situation is wholly good, completely good or bad, and begun to appreciate the golden mean. I had to look up what the golden mean was. It's a philosophical idea from Aristotle where, you know, you're trying to find some middle way, like what the Buddhists talk about, between the extremes, you know, the all, the nothing, the never, the always, trying to find some middle way. And I think if we go back to the idea of transactional analysis, we've got the extreme of the parent mode, you've got the extreme of the child mode, the middle way is the adult mode. Tony, before we sign off, give us a pearl of wisdom.
Just to touch on it, like, any situation is not wholly good or bad. I'll probably bring it back to football. I'll use the example of Liverpool United in a couple of weeks' time. The match will happen. It is a situation. They're due to play each other. Liverpool will win 3-0. And the situation is not wholly good or bad, because it depends on what perspective you're looking at it from. So I'm looking at it from a very good perspective, because I'm delighted we're getting 3 points and I can slag you off for the week. But it's the situation, but it's how we view it. And we're viewing it from our own internal perspective. So you're looking at it from a United fan, so that you'll see it as bad. I'm looking at it from a Liverpool fan, so I'd see it as good. But the match was just a match, and the match just ended up 3-0. So it's how you view any situation. So that's from the book Zen and the Art of Happiness, that example. And I think it's absolutely brilliant, because you can look at any situation of not being one thing or the other, but it's how we internalize it, or it's from our internal frame of reference. So hopefully that will be the result in 2 weeks' time. And I get to rub it in your face for a couple of days.
Great example, yeah. And I think the middle way, you know, is really the way. There's so much, I think social media plays a huge part in kind of driving people out to the extremes, and that all or nothing thinking is extremely unhealthy. And of course, Tony was quoting from a book called Zen and the Art of Deluded Liverpool Fans there.
just to finish up on that, the middle way is the fact that if we're watching the match together, that the two of us enjoyed the experience of watching the match. And that goes back to gambling. That doesn't have to be all or nothing or good or bad. And it's usually, we think that it has to be good if we win money on it, or it definitely is bad if we lose money on it. But the whole thing is that you can actually sit down and watch it and enjoy it for what it is. And just kind of thought, you know what, the lost or the won, what about, does that really have an impact on my life going forward? No. And on to the next match. And that's the great thing with football, is always next year, as you'll find out this year yourselves.
Thanks, Tony. On that beautiful note, we'll wind up for today, and I'll post the rest of that list because there's a lot of good stuff in it. But I suppose just back briefly to that idea of trying to achieve emotional maturity, I think that transactional analysis concept is a good way of looking at it. I hope, folks, you found that useful today, and we'll talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye.